Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Nearly 1 million more Massachusetts residents are eligible for vaccines today.
While I know the vaccine is not 100%, nothing is, it's almost like having that extra layer of security.
Even as schools fully reopen for elementary students and new cases seem relentless, how dangerous is this moment? The Derek Chauvin murder trial is happening 1,400 miles away, but it still somehow feels like it's happening to us.
Racism is alive and well in Boston and Massachusetts. In order to get rid of racism, we have to be as intentional as it was to create it, and we're not there yet.
And in our Living Through Corona series, how a mentor and mentee in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program grew their relationship even from far away.
What's actually happened in this last year is we've been able to get much closer together.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts has been in the final phase of reopening, phase four, since March 22nd. And as of today, 1 million more Massachusetts residents are eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. So that includes people over age 55, and those with a qualifying health condition, think moderate to severe asthma, heart condition, type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Now, in addition, 90% of Massachusetts school districts returned to full-time in-person learning for elementary students today. Meanwhile, new coronavirus cases in schools have hit a record high for the academic year. Last week, there were 801 new cases among students and 244 new cases among school staffers. The number of Massachusetts communities in the high-risk red zone has more than doubled over the last 2 weeks, up to 55 communities. So there are competing milestones here. How do we make sense of them? We have asked Dr. David Hamer, a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, to help us. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Dr. Hamer.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this feels like sort of a, oh, captain, my captain moment, Dr. Hamer, where we have to turn to you. Is this as confusing as it feels? Are we really seeing competing signs in this pandemic right now?
I think we are. I mean, this is a challenging time. The vaccine rollout is picking up pace, and that's a good sign. And countries where high levels of immunization have been reached are seeing declines in cases, but we are not there yet. Instead, we're facing a competing demand or competing impact of new, you know, I think, variants of concern, as well as perhaps, you know, the economy opening more and more gatherings, you know, in restaurants and other public places that might facilitate transmission. So we sort of have two things that are counteracting each other concurrently.
So let's dive in on this idea of this race between the vaccines, between vaccinations and these variants. So I know that Dr. Fauci has said that if we stick to public health measures and the pace of vaccinations, we could or should win that race quickly. But I also know that we have spread, we have deaths, we are not all sticking to the public health measures that Dr. Fauci would want us to around the country. So I want to get really specific. With practices as they currently stand here in the Commonwealth, and with the pace of vaccine supply and distribution that we currently have in the Commonwealth, do you think the variants are going to win this race in the short term and we're going to have a fourth surge?
I hope not. The variants, P1, the Brazil variant, has been identified in quite a number of people, you know, primarily on the Cape. And then B117 has become dominant in many parts of the state. And so they clearly, the variants are moving very quickly. And, you know, B117, the UK variant, appears to be more readily transmissible and actually may be associated with more severe outcomes. So that's a very worrisome scenario. If things go really well with the vaccine over the next 2 to 4 weeks, we may end up blunting what appears to be the beginning of a fourth wave. I think part of this is going to require the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and surrounding states, including travelers into the state, to keep their guard up, to continue mask use in public places, to try and limit gatherings. And honestly, despite the fact that restaurants are open and sports venues are now open for sort of fans, I think people going out to these places need to be really cautious. And, unless they're vaccinated, and even if they're vaccinated, there still is a risk there in public places until such time as the rates of infection really drop off.
So if people, however, do practice care, masking or double masking, appropriate social distancing, et cetera, are you saying that if we do those things, then given where we are in the reopening and where we are with the spread of, and for listeners, just to explain, each newly identified variant has its own name. P1 refers to the one that was identified in Brazil. B117, as Dr. Hamer said, refers to the one that was identified in the UK. Can we stay secure against those and have the vaccination win the race against the variants?
Yes, I think we can. I mean, I think that if part of the challenge we face right now is people are suffering pandemic fatigue. I mean, people are just sort of tired of being cooped up, working from home, schooling from home, not being able to socialize with their friends. And then in public, I think that mask use is still recommended, but people are getting tired of wearing a mask. So in some places, people aren't being as cautious, and we need to really change that. This is a time of real great concern where these measures need to be implemented and effectively in order to control spread as we have these new variants of concern really trying to make their way in the state.
Are children more susceptible to these variants than to the original COVID-19, I don't know what to say, virus or original variant? Variant's not the right word. You understand what I'm trying to ask.
No, I understand. So it's really, I mean, they're sort of variant, they're really strains of the virus in a way, with changes in the spike protein. I don't know that, I have not seen any evidence that children are more susceptible to, say, the Brazilian or the UK or the South African variant. So I don't think that's the case. I think with children, clearly there have been more cases identified in children. And I wonder if some of this is because there's more testing being done, that there's more systematic testing being done in some school systems. And therefore, they're identifying children that, if we go back 8-10 months, well, first of all, many of those children would not have been in school because schools were closed down, but there was no systematic testing being done. And so they might not have been identified at that point in time.
So, for example, the pool testing that's being done in more than 150 school districts around the Commonwealth may be catching more in children than we were catching before. Is that what you're saying?
Precisely. Yes.
Okay, so with that in mind, we know that we are seeing more cases identified in schools. We also know that the majority of the spread, as it's being reported, is not coming from schools. We heard your answer on how the variants relate to kids, what we do and don't know. Today, 90% of the school districts in the Commonwealth fully reopened for in-person learning for elementary schools. Later this month, middle schools are due to do the same. There's not a date set for high schools yet. Are you concerned about spread in schools right now? And how safe should parents feel for their kids and for themselves as kids go back full time?
I'd say I'm concerned, but I think that if the control measures that have been adopted by most school systems are effectively implemented in terms of some degree of social distancing within schools, mask use during school hours, and trying to sort of keep students apart during, lunchtime. And then on top of that, pooled testing or some sort of testing strategy, including surveillance, asymptomatic surveillance to try and identify children that may be infected but have no symptoms. and then separating them, you know, having them go home and be in isolation, you know, all those measures should work to control spread within schools and allow the schools to be open and running in a normal way. If we look back to the fall, those kinds of measures are exactly what was done at many institutions of higher education across the state, including MIT, Harvard, and Boston University. And we were able to keep things in very reasonable control with those kinds of measures.
So let's stay with schools for a minute longer, and then I want to go back to vaccines. But Dr. Ashish Jha once suggested, he's at Brown, once suggested that we should consider a trade-off between reopening schools and other places. So, for example, if we want to reopen schools, maybe we don't reopen bars or clubs. Now, bars remain closed. They're in a later step of phase four. But, for example, restaurants are open without capacity limits as long as social distancing is in place. As you said, stadiums are open, like Fenway Park and TD Garden. I called in from opening day at Fenway last Friday to hear to Radio Boston. So we are now also reopening schools to full-time learning. We appear not to be following what Dr. Jha was recommending. Should we be, or are we now, with the pace of vaccinations where it is, able to afford a little more risk and to do these things simultaneously, in your mind?
Well, I must say I'm fall closer to Dr. Jha's recommendations in this regard. I mean, I've been worried the last 3 weeks or so that restaurants reopened to full capacity, you know, with shorter hours or shorter duration of individual visits. But the reality is that that happened in early March, and we've seen a surge in cases in March, which may be partly due to reopening the economy, including restaurants. It may also just be an effect of the variants that have reached the state and that have been spreading rapidly. But in any case, I think that, you know, if anything, I would favor having schools open because of the many benefits, both to, you know, children in the schools and their families, as opposed to restaurants and other kinds of public venues. At this point, they're both open, and I think we need to do our best to try and optimize the use of individual and public control measures in order to try and reduce the risk while we wait and hope for the vaccine effect to have an impact.
And to that point, you said just now, the waiting and hoping for the vaccine effect. I think one of the questions on people's minds is, when are we going to be at that point, do you think, where we have some kind of equilibrium between vaccine supply and demand? So if you want to get a vaccine, you can actually get one readily and accessibly and fairly quickly.
Well, I'm going to have to look into a crystal ball to answer that question.
But, is it hard to know right now?
Well, you know, the vaccine availability has been steadily increasing, and but still, I hear stories almost every day of people struggling to get appointments or having to get an appointment to get the vaccine at a place that's relatively far from where they live. And so it's certainly not at a level of convenience to all. And I think the plan is to liberalize the sort of eligibility groups more over the next couple of weeks, you know, by mid-April, hopefully opening it up to almost all adults. Will we have a sufficient vaccine supply? Will we have sufficient delivery centers? Is it going to be easy enough to make appointments? A lot of questions that I'm not sure about at this point in time.
All right. And April 19th is that date, Patriots Day, for opening it up to adults. That's Dr. David Hamer. He's a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and a professor at Boston University School of Public Health. You're generous with your time. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, WBUR contributor Kimberly Atkins on local impacts of the Derek Chauvin trial. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to Radio Boston. Sometimes events far away have such deep repercussions, or they hit us in such a personal way that they feel like they're happening to us. And for many, that is the case with the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was charged with murder in the death of George Floyd 10 months ago. The video of Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May has sparked outcry all over the world. So the trial is now in its second week, and it has America watching with our collective breath held, both because of the pain of reliving the events of Floyd's killing and because of the uncertainty around the event and what it could mean in our own cities and towns. Here's Michael Curry. He is president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP board on Radio Boston last Friday about the deep resonance of the trial here.
Racism is alive and well in Boston and Massachusetts. We, in some cases, can be the best of the worst, but that should not make us feel good. There's a police officer stopping and disrespecting someone who has black or brown skin right now, somewhere in the Commonwealth, because they're carrying their biases or their racial animus. We saw it on January 6th. People harbor hate. We got to be real clear that in order to get rid of racism, we have to be as intentional as it was to create it. And we're not there yet.
The Boston Globe's Kimberly Atkins has also been speaking about why a trial 1,400 miles away is so painful and so important to us here in Greater Boston. Atkins is a senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe, an inaugural columnist for The Emancipator, which is a new publication in Boston's abolitionist tradition created by the Globe and Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. She's also a WBUR contributor, and she joins us now. Kimberly, always great to have you.
Hi, Tiziana.
Kimberly, have you been watching the trial closely? And if so, how has that been for you?
Yes, I have. And I think, I'm watching this through a number of lenses. I'm watching this as a former attorney, aware that the purpose of this trial is the prosecution trying to prove its case against Derek Chauvin, and that is not always an easy task to do. I'm watching it as a journalist who is reporting on what this trial means, not just for Minneapolis, but for the nation. And I'm watching it as a woman of color who every time there is another one of these videos showing brutality against a black man or a black woman by police, it is a part of the trauma that we all feel. And the desire to see justice done and to feel like we have a nation that does not see black and brown folks is inherently dangerous, that does not put our lives in danger potentially at every police interaction. So it is it can be difficult balancing all of those things. But that's the way I've been seeing it for the past more than a week now.
Do you think that a lot of people are coming to this trial? Again, it's in Minneapolis. So if you live in Minneapolis, you're coming at it one way. But we're really talking about here in our community. Also coming at it sort of from a place of intersectionality, lots of different identities, lots of different needs and interests about both the process of the trial and the potential outcome.
Yes. And I think that's absolutely true for everyone. And I want to be clear, it's not just for Black folks and people of color who are watching this from a certain standpoint. Lots of Americans who really want to see justice done, who want to believe that we do have a justice system that does not treat people differently based on race, or that when that does happen, that there is accountability for it, are watching this. And it's two different broad audiences. The audience, the American public in general, are looking at this and hoping that it reflects something that they believe their justice system should represent. And that might be different from what the jury in this case is tasked with doing, which is deciding whether the prosecution proved each element of the charges that Derek Chauvin faces. And those things may dissect. We've seen them dissect in the past in cases where charges weren't even brought against officers because there was no clear violation of policies, in cases where there was not a conviction, even when we did see a trial. And that compounds the national trauma that so many of us feel, that the idea that not only was this injustice perpetuated, but that there is no vehicle, there is no way for accountability. And that's really damaging for society. So even though those aren't the same things, they're both very, very important here.
You know, I want to come to the question of race in this trial for a minute. You wrote a tweet last week that really struck me and sat with me. It said, quote, "We need a word for that feeling when Black, Indigenous, and people of color Americans pray for justice while also simultaneously bracing for denial. Is that what you're expecting here?
Yes, I think that's a very, very likely here. It has, history has shown that it is very difficult to secure a conviction of a police officer for the injury and death that occurs at his or her hands in the line of duty. We've seen that that is a very difficult thing to do in this country. So yes, you do brace for what feels like a denial of justice when you see on tape in a video something that seems so clearly out of line, so clearly a violation of the civil and human rights of George Floyd. But we know that it doesn't always end in a conviction, end in a sense that justice will be served and that it may help to prevent that from happening again. So that's what I mean by that bracing for justice not to be served, even though you pray for it. And every time that failure to have accountability happens, it compounds the trauma that I feel. It compounds the trauma that a lot of us feel when we see these injustices happening. When we talk about things like policies, like wearing body cams or people videotaping, being allowed to videotape police interactions, there was a fight for that. But then we saw, not just with George Floyd, but with Eric Garner and others, when it is really clear, when it is on video, there still seems to be that lack of justice. So I think that is what I meant when I tweeted that, is that we have to be prepared. We do brace ourselves at the beginning of an event like this trial, because we know that the outcome can bring that additional blow, that additional trauma at its end.
I want to bring some data into this, Kimberly. The Washington Post has reported that law enforcement officers kill about 1,000 people a year in the U.S. And according to data compiled by Philip Stinson, who's a criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University, since 2005, 121 officers have been arrested on charges of murder or manslaughter over on-duty killings. 44 of those officers were convicted, but most of those were for a lesser crime. Only 5 were convicted of murder, 11 for manslaughter. That data seems to speak to what you were just saying, and I'm so mindful that you're approaching this as an attorney and a journalist and a citizen and a woman of color. Does that tell you that there are policy issues or issues of what is codified in law that are at play that need to be addressed long term as well?
Absolutely. And one of the most basic issues is the standard that is used for police officers to use force in the line of duty. It is the level of threat or dangerousness that they perceive. It is subjective. It is in the eye of the police officer. And so if you have a criminal justice system, as we do, which has inherent racial inequities, which has implicit biases, which make Black and brown folks seem and be considered more dangerous than other people, automatically that creates a different standard. That means that a Black and brown person in any police interaction is more likely to be, to have force used against him or her. And so you're already starting in an unequal place. There's also policies that prevent law enforcement, that prevents law enforcement officers from being charged civilly if they commit these crimes with qualified immunity. There are also policies that make it very difficult to meet the standard. I mean, in this case, the prosecutors have to show that Derek Chauvin intended to commit an assault against George Floyd in order for that highest charge against him, that second degree murder charge, to be reached. That's a hard standard to reach. That they're bringing in testimony such as from the police chief today that says he violated policy, and that can go a long way, but it's still not guaranteed that they will make that high legal bar. So there are absolutely policy considerations here, the way we think about police interactions with people, that make that accountability much harder to achieve.
So we had you bring all your hats on air today, and we were just talking with you with your lawyer hat on. I want to talk to you with your hat as the inaugural columnist for The Emancipator for a minute.
Yeah.
You heard the quote from Michael Curry at the top, talking about what we have to struggle with still here in the Commonwealth. And I really want to bring this home. What are the conversations we need to be having right now in Massachusetts, given where we are in our journey on police reform? State law has been passed. The city of Boston is engaged in reform. The Supreme Judicial Court is taking a clear-eyed look at the role of race and incarceration. Our dinner tables, our classrooms. What are the conversations you hunger for us to be having right now as this trial unfolds?
You know, even when I was a journalism student and I did ride-alongs with police, it was very clear that the systemic problems in policing affect cops too. It makes it harder for them to do their jobs. It makes it harder for them to earn the trust of the community that they need in order to police it well, in order to protect it, in order to be seen as a partner as opposed to a threat. And it you have to break down one's own inherent biases, about Black and Brown folks. And those are the conversations that need to happen. You're right. In Massachusetts, a lot is happening in terms of policing reform. That reform on the state level, at least, did not include that qualified immunity issue that I talked about, which is so important to preventing this kind of brutality. But people have to talk and learn and teach and understand each other from a place of humanity and not just from a place of perceived threat. And that happens at dinner tables. That happens in communities talking to one another. That's something that police officers have to engage in too. It is not easy work, but it's necessary work.
Kimberly, in the less than a minute that we have left, is there a way to sort of lay out or paraphrase what justice would look like here in your mind?
Justice is when accountability looks and feels equal. When someone steps out of line, when somebody commits a crime, that they are held against, that they are held accountable for it. That when somebody does not commit a crime, when somebody does something like pass a $20 bill, that does not come with a death sentence. And that race does not seem to be the clear through line that makes the difference in one or the other. That's the place to start when we're talking about justice.
And that is Kimberly Atkins, a senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe, inaugural columnist for The Emancipator, and a WBUR contributor. Kimberly, as I said, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay tuned. We're going to go to a break, but there is more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Big Brothers Big Sisters of Massachusetts Bay is the largest youth mentoring agency in New England. They serve over 3,600 boys and girls a year in over 100 communities. The boys and girls enrolled in the program are typically between 7 and 12 and are enrolled by a parent or a guardian. Now, the mentors and mentees in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program are called Bigs and Littles. And as with so many other programs, Bigs and Littles had to change their approach pretty significantly when the pandemic struck. As part of our ongoing series of interviews about life during the pandemic, we spoke with Jesse Stetton, who is a big for Big Brothers Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts. Jesse's a mentor to Demetrius, a 13-year-old from Greater Boston. Recently, Jesse told us what it's been like navigating the pandemic and conversations around race and how the events of this past year have influenced his relationship with Demetrius.
The Big Brothers Big Sisters program is a one-to-one mentorship program that's really designed to defend the potential of youth in our communities. So bigs, like myself, get paired up in a one-to-one relationship with littles, typically between the ages of 7 and 11. And you really build a friendship. And that's, I think, why they so aptly call it, you know, big brothers and big sisters as opposed to big mentors or whatnot, because it really is that sort of like familial friendship that you form with your littles.
And how long have you and Demetrius been a big and a little?
Yeah, so Demetrius and I have been, I guess we've been brothers for 3 years now.
So when the pandemic hit, you're 3 years into your relationship, what most worried you for how you would go forward with Demetrius.
Yeah, I think when the pandemic first hit and we were trying to figure out as a society, you know, what was okay in terms of spending time together indoors, outdoors, with masks, without masks, I was initially very worried because our relationship was built on the fundamentals of spending in-person quality time together pretty much every other week. And so I was worried about how we are going to, if and how we are going to be able to transform that into a virtual relationship. I was worried about not being able to spend, quality in-person time if we weren't able to be outdoors together.
So it's a year later now. Did that prove to be the biggest challenge, or were you surprised? Was there some other thing that wound up being the hardest part?
So while my concerns about spending time together were sort of prevalent a year ago, what's actually happened in this last year is we've been able to get much closer together. So though our relationship certainly has transformed in terms of the way we spend time together, we spend much more time virtually, whether that's video chatting and each cooking dinner together separately. So a couple of weeks ago, I dropped off a bag of groceries for Demetrius. I had my own bag of groceries, same ingredients in them. And we video chatted and cooked dinner remotely together. Or we play any one of the number of cell phone games that the kids are playing these days. Or we've been able to spend some time together in person, outdoors, distant and masked. So I would say, I think the challenges of this last year have really helped us build our relationship and have some challenging conversations that we might not have had to have if not for the events of the last year.
Let's talk about those challenging conversations. Can you tell me more about what you mean about that?
Sure. So I think while the pandemic was certainly a headline of this last year of life, I think another big element of this past year was the murder of George Floyd and the sort of rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think that sparked a lot of really good and sometimes challenging conversations between the two of us.
And to be clear, you're white and Demetrius is Black, right?
Correct.
And how did you, first, did you get any help in having those conversations? Did you get, you know, resources from Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts or from other places? And how did you enter into those conversations with Demetrius?
Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts was really helpful in guiding these conversations around race. When George Floyd was murdered and we were in this pandemic, Big Brothers Big Sisters sent out messages to all of the Big Brothers and Big Sisters in the community with some general tips about how to have important conversations, as well as specific activities and exercises that can be done remotely around identity and race being a part of identity, and how both Big Brothers and Little Brothers would sort of map out what they view as their identity and what they imagine other people's view of their identity upon seeing them. And so that sort of created a space for conversation around identity. And then I personally wasn't, you know, as you mentioned, as a white big with a little of color, I wasn't quite sure how to exactly have these conversations and start them. And thankfully, each match in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program has someone dedicated as their match support. So my match support since the very beginning is an amazing woman named Chantel, and I was able to have a really in-depth conversation and a very vulnerable conversation with her about what my role is, both as a big brother and acknowledging the fact that I am a white big brother and my little brother is a little brother of color, and to try to figure out how to start those conversations and really create the space for Demetrius to share his perspective and to enter into those conversations.
And if you could look back on this last year and pick one moment that will be most precious to you, what would it be?
I think it was the gift that Demetrius got me for my birthday. So I'm not generally a big gift person, but he bought me a Black Lives Matters t-shirt for my birthday. And I thought it was one of the most touching and beautiful gifts that I had ever received, both because he and I have discussed the Black Lives Matter movement in great detail, and he knows that it's something that I personally very much care about. So it was a reflection of Demetrius listening to me, caring and hearing what I care about, and getting me a very specific gift related to it. And it very much felt like it was sort of this beautiful cycle of what Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts creates, which is creating relationships between people who otherwise probably wouldn't be in relationship together. And I think that quite personally, that the Black Lives Matters movement means a heck of a lot more than it ever did, because I have a little brother who I love, who's a little brother of color.
And that is Jesse Stetton, a big brother for Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts. Jesse, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been great to be here today.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.